This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Stamfords Travel Writers Festival, please welcome, in conversation with Julia Wheeler, it's Yestyn Edwards and Michael Bristow.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival. This is the final event, and it's going to be a corker, I have to say. These two books are very, very different books, but they do have one thing in common, and that is dressing in drag. So I think the best thing to do is to begin by just you, both of you telling us about these books. And then I don't know where it's going after that, but it will be going somewhere and it will be entertaining. So, Michael, begin. Tell us about the premise of China in Drag.
Well, I was a journalist for the BBC in Beijing. I've been there for about 5 years and I was about to leave. And I had the immodesty to think that I could write a book about something. So I decided to write a book about my teacher, my language teacher. He's about as old as communist China, and the ups and downs of his life have mirrored China's ups and downs. And anyway, we decided to travel around China to tell his story. And on our first night away, we'd gone to a hotel and I decided we'd had separate rooms, and we went off to our rooms and agreed to meet at 8 o'clock that evening for dinner. So 8 o'clock, I opened my room door, stepped out into the corridor and looked down the corridor towards the lift, and there was the teacher standing near the lift, dressed as a woman. Now, this is a man who previously I'd known for 5 years. We'd met in a coffee shop twice a week to learn Chinese. He'd given very little indication that he was a cross-dresser up until that point, so you can imagine my surprise. He had high heels on, tight white trousers, full makeup. And he just kind of wafted a hand across his clothes and said, "You don't mind, do you?" And so therefore, that was the start of a different kind of book.
And did you mind?
I didn't mind. I consider myself quite liberal, like most of us do in Britain. We would like to think that we wouldn't mind if lots of things which happen to us, you know, we would have an open mind. But actually, there was something about it that made me feel quite awkward at the beginning. So we were walking through the city, and there he was tottering on these high heels, which he said he loved, but I don't believe he could walk very well in. And I did feel quite awkward as people sort of like would glance and say, you know, Western man, Chinese pensioner dressed as a woman, what's going on?
not what you'd expect to see.
Exactly. So, but I got over that, did get used to it, yeah.
And did you sort of kick yourself for almost not realising earlier, given that, you know, you're a journalist, you're out there observing, you've got your eyes and ears open?
Yeah, I mean, that was a big thing. I mean, I purport to be a journalist for the BBC, so I'm supposed to be able to see things and interpret them. And when I think back to our lessons, he would occasionally turn up with kind of glowing lips. And I thought, is he wearing makeup? No. It must be, Beijing's quite cold in the winter, so I thought he'd put maybe lip balm on, or he'd have maybe a delicate piece of jewellery or a tight T-shirt. And I just dismissed that and thought, well, maybe he's just being self-expressive, but perhaps he was trying to tell me something that I wasn't really looking for, which doesn't actually say a lot for my abilities as a journalist, I'm afraid to say.
But the book does, and we'll come back to that in a second. So my tutu went AWOL, possibly the funkiest title at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival.
Hooray.
Tell us about how, from the beginning, about how you came to be dressed in a tutu in front of troops in Iraq and Afghanistan.
I saw ballet when I was 18 and became obsessed with it. I was working front of house, selling programmes, and I wanted to be the Swan Queen. So I started to pick up the steps. I built an act. I was overheard singing out of my kitchen window by the president of the Alborough Music Club, and they'd just been let down. Their lead baritone had come down with better gig-itis. So I replaced him on that Thursday. Libby Purvis came to see me, started booking me for the National Maritime Museum. First Sea Lord booked me, and then said to go to Combined Services Entertainment.
Let me just...
Sorry.
So these bookings, though, they were not you as a ballerina?
No, No, the ballerina was something I did for parties parallel. And I didn't know that Combined Services Entertainment had been keeping tabs on the ballerina because they didn't want me to sing. And they needed to know that I had enough gob on me to deal with Royal Marines Commandos when they kicked off, which they do when you're entertaining them. And this poor bloke had only come in to redo the toner in the photocopier. So I roped him in to help with my act. And they knew two things now. One, that I did have enough gob on me to deal with Royal Marines. And two, this poor bloke is still on beta blockers. So they... I thought I'd auditioned, though, ladies and gentlemen, to perform at the Hilton in Park Lane. And I didn't click where what the tour was. And they started... They said, your security is of paramount importance to us. And I thought, right, I'll use the subway. I won't cross Park Lane to the Hilton. And... You're going to have to wear a Kevlar helmet and a metal jacket. And I thought, well, it's a bit heavy. It might ruin my high notes, but you're paying me. I'll wear what you like. And you will have to bed down behind the wire with the squaddies, which I thought was a great perk. And then what am I going to be like with the temperatures in Iraq and the desert conditions and the threat of insurgency attack?
And so, as all this slowly started to dawn, were you thinking, yeah, not what I thought, let's back out?
I could either have backed out, but I went. They said afterwards, we knew that you didn't know, but we wondered, would you not come? And I did. I went to Bryce Norton and I went on the plane. I'm still traumatised by it, but I went.
So I think for those of us of a certain age are thinking about Combined Entertainment Services.
Combined Services Entertainment.
Is kind of, it ain't half hot mum and me, yeah. The gang, cause the boys are here, that one. Anything like that?
Well, no, they were trying to ring changes because they had started to very much take football managers and Page Three girls. And obviously I was at the end of an evening of stand-up, Rod Gilbert, Jeannie Ashray, Paul Tonkinson and Andy Askins. And then it was, and now for something completely different. And I arrive and tank in there. So they were trying to ring changes, and I was the experiment.
Okay, we're going to leave it there just
Thank
for a moment
you,
and come back to
Michael. I'm still traumatised.
So the wonderful thing about your book is that you tell the story of China through the eyes of this one man who is your teacher, and he remains anonymous throughout the book. And in some ways, the fact that he's... in drag doesn't really matter because it is his story, isn't it? So how did you manage to weave him and his country together?
Well, it is quite difficult because we all know China's a big country, it's growing, we all buy stuff which is made there, but we don't know very much about it. What are the people like? Where is the country going? It seems very, very alien. So I wanted to present it on a kind of human level, something where, you know, people can identify with other people who live similar lives. And as I said, my teacher, he's about as old as communist China. So, you know, he was sent away in the 1960s by Mao. He came back, he left his schooling. He went to university in his 30s, married late, tried to start a business. All the kind of success and failures of communist China have essentially been the same as his success and failures. And I thought if I just copied that, his one life, then people could understand a little bit more about what it is to be Chinese and what they feel like. And as you say, the fact that he dressed up in drag was slightly incidental, but it did give it a nice twist, and it did allow us to explore some things which or draw out some characteristics of Chinese people that I hadn't thought of before. So tolerance, for example. Chinese people seem to be more tolerant of people who have differences, different sexual or gender expressions, than perhaps you might find in Britain, which I found quite surprising. They seem quite tolerant of it. And so...
Is there quite a history of cross-dressing in China?
There is. I mean, the biggest thing is Chinese opera. I mean, if anybody ever goes to China, you'll go to Beijing Opera, where people kind of singing at very high-pitched levels, and you probably won't understand it. But most of the main parts are men playing women. So often that creates quite complex roles. So there's a story of Mulan, for example, the Disney character, the woman who dresses up, the young woman who dresses up as a boy to play in the army. Well, if you play that on stage, you might have a man playing Mulan, a woman who dresses up as a young man. So you have all kinds of complicated ideas. So there is a history of cross-dressing in China and of tolerance, and I think that's why there's a lot of tolerance around China, even in rural areas where we travelled around to.
It's a very emotional journey at times, excuse me, for the teacher. Excuse me.
A Theresa May moment.
No, don't say that. I'm thinking particularly when you travel together back to the place where he was sent to in the country, Double River Farm. Tell us the story and about why he was sent there, because it made a huge change in his life, didn't it, at the time?
It's an extraordinary story, which people might have heard of, some of it, but not a lot of it, because in China they just don't talk about this, because they can't. But in the 1960s, there was something called Red Guards. These were young people whipped up by Mao to create chaos. They got out of control, so Mao decided, OK, these kids, we need to send them away from the cities where they can't do any danger. So he sent them away to the countries, and we're talking about a vast country, to the far, you know, wastes of the north, or the kind of the heat of the south. My teacher was sent to the northeast, right on the border with Russia. It's under snow and ice for much of the year. He spent 7 years there. He missed his schooling. He was sent there when he was late teens, but in the years before, the school had just stopped. So he basically wasted a decade of his life, and much of it spent there. And lots of people now who are his age, he's in his 60s, try to look back on that time and try to make sense of it, and it's very difficult because they live in a country where officially they can't talk about it, so they're left to try and come to terms with that period of their lives themselves and make sense of what they can themselves and on their own. So he went back to the place with me and kind of met old friends, visited places where essentially he'd been held a prisoner for 7 years. So I mean, the horrific tales. And there's millions and millions of these stories. If it was in Britain, we would still be processing all this, but it's something that just isn't really talked about in China.
Mm. Right, now we've got you on a plane from Bryce Norton.
Yes.
With your kit on.
Yeah.
Tell us about what happened when you arrived in Iraq.
Well, when I'd sung for the first Sea Lord, I'd sung on the HMS Victory for the naval supper marking the 200th anniversary of the Battle of Trafalgar. So I had met the Royal Marines commando called Stax, who is 6'2", baby of face, blue of eye, and rocky of outcrop. And he was on Victory because his granny used to be a church organist in Marsden, near where you're from. And he was given all the artistic things to do. So when we get to the Basra A-pod, there is the 6'2", baby of face, blue of eye, rocky of outcrop, Royal Marines commando Stax again, looking after us.
And did you realise that he was going to be there?
No, I'd been told he might be there, which they thought would convince me to go more than just wanting to face the danger. So he was our guard and guide for the place. And all the colour is gone. You're just seeing the squaddies' uniforms. There's the wire, there's the anti-blast wall, which I almost immediately got bollocked for drying my pink ballet tights on the top of it. There's the mountains, and there's fires all along the horizon where they're burning the oil, and just noise from generators and tanks passing and helicopters going. So it's just a constant colourless and petrol smell everywhere. So it's an assault of noise and danger. I mean, they bombed the nearby railway station the first night that we were there. There was shelling just as the gig started on the next day. So you were constantly reminded, yeah, this is a war zone. I was learning to time my punchlines and wait, right, detonate, right, don't go for the punchline at the same time as a shell, if I could.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how many shows did you have to do there?
You do one, so you're there for about 10 days. I went 4 times, 1 Iraq, 3 Afghanistan. And you're there about 10 days and you do a show a day or 2 a day. So I must have done about 40 in all, I think, in the tour.
And pretty tough crowd, I'm thinking.
Do you know, it was the most... I was afraid of things in this order, that the squaddies would kick off and not like my act. Camel spiders, because they are the most horrific thing known to man. And 3, insurgency or Taliban attack. I was scared of that last. And the only thing is, what got me through the first one, I was going to climb the wire. I was to get away from the first gig in Umkazar, where I fell foul of status anyway. And the thing, can I do a bit of a demonstration? Should we have a demonstration?
Yeah, I think we need to see this show.
I was
really
literally backstage in my tutu with my body armor still on, because I kept getting bollocked for not having my body armor on. And I was still remembering, when you arrive on stage as Princess Aurora, you must come down the stairs very delicately, as my ballet teacher said, because you are a mythical princess and you're showing the blessings of your fairy godmother, and you are not Godzilla, has just boosted itself out of the Thames to square up to County Hall. That was actually going through my head as I came on stage.
That's professional.
It's the only way I could keep the fear from destroying my little mind, I think. And then it all... We've got that, actually, a bit of it. Aled, are you ready? Here's one we made earlier.
Number 7.
Look how brilliant I am.
Stand there, present me, and await further instructions.
Big finish.
In the minute, I'm going to stop spinning up and above, I'm going to come, and you're going to catch me.
Don't watch this. Applauding, don't just sit there. Thank you. Tough crowd.
Worse than the Royal Marines.
Not as pretty. Sorry.
I mean, we're all laughing at, you know, the whole atmosphere of it, but, you know, your calves, impressive.
Very, very
tough. How many
tough
twirls do you... they're not called twirls. What
48.
Are they?
48. Pirouettes. My record is 48. I did 48 a couple of times.
And where did you learn to do those?
Just in the foyer of the Royal Opera House. There was an ex-ballerina selling programmes, and she still can't explain how I picked it all up because I was not trained. I was 18 when I first saw ballet, and it's just an obsession I added to it, and then she suddenly discovered I could do fouettes. Mm. And that's it. It's kept my fridge full ever since.
It's not a pirouette.
No, pirouettes are the general term. Fouettes are when you do whip fouette.
Get with it, Michael. and so, I mean, your act, that is a part of it.
Yes.
But there's quite a lot before and after. How do you pick people from the audience?
I've developed...
Everybody put your head down.
Well, they do.
Who would you pick from the audience here?
Him, because he was late, and I would do my gag. Why were you late? He's been over there, and I'd say, I came from Moscow and I was on time. Rubbish. He'd get picked. There's always got to be a pretty one, and then there's got to be one. Everyone's going, pick him, so that you pick the one that they're all pointing at and hope that you're not going to fall foul. I did fall foul.
But so. Did you have to be quite careful, given that there's such a hierarchy within the military of not picking people
that
could get you into trouble?
The thing about Stax is, because he was Regimental Sergeant Major, on our first night we got a security brief, and then which was about insurgency attack and that they were getting what they were doing and wearing our body armour. Then he stayed behind with me and said, I am Regimental Sergeant Major. I've watched your act on YouTube. You are leaving me alone and unmolested at the back of the venue. the other Marines pushed him on the stage, and all I said to him, and this was my first gig, was, are our muscles for use in warfare, or are they just for gay display? And I didn't finish the set. He grabbed me by the back of the tutu, put me over his shoulder, ran out of the venue with me to the wire and dumped me on the turret of a tank and made me sing what I'd sung on the HMS Victory to be lifted down again. So the first act, I didn't pick wrong. I shouldn't have been lippy to him. He was furious.
But the relationship picked up.
Yeah, he taught me to drive, ladies and gentlemen. And also, when I was doing Dames in Blackpool, I couldn't get home. He lived in Manchester. So on Boxing Day, 3 years running, he drove over from Manchester because he was trained to chef in the Marines and cooked Christmas lunch for me on Boxing Day. So we're mates now, but it was very touch and go for the,
from the
first
stage.
Month or so.
Can I just ask a question?
Yes, do.
I'm interested. What do the Royal Marines... kicking off, you've mentioned that a couple of times. What does that look like?
On the they come to both nights. What happens is you get to a venue, and say it's looking like this. The squaddies get to the venue really early to see what's going on. They watch it being set up. They watch your sound checks. Between you all coming, when it was the Marines' base, they came back from patrol, threw everyone out of the front two rows, commandeered armchairs for wherever they got them. So when you get on stage, there are Marines in the front two rows, all in armchairs. On the first night, they're silent and they watch you. On the second night, they sit deconstructing your material for you. That's an old line. I wouldn't use that there. Oh, yeah, you didn't say that last night, literally doing that. And then one of the other... I love this comedian. I won't name him because he's still ashamed of it. He made a crack about their sex lives. They heckled. He didn't have a put-down, and it was like someone brought a choir in. Were you born such a... such a? And they sang, and he left the stage. And then I'm up next, and they're baying for blood. I won that. I smacked one of them that night. I just thought, this is them or me, and this is quite serious. And Stax, we were mates by then, he was sitting at the side going, handle it, don't smack the big one, because he didn't want to step in.
But weren't you told that actually if that pack changes...
You move.
Yeah, there's no point in fighting it.
They hunt as a pack. We were told, it's not like there's a fire blanket and you try and put the fire out without endangering yourself. You walk, you get off the stage. That's what you do.
One of the images that jumps out from your book is the two of you on the backs of motorbikes. Tell us about that story.
Yes, me and the teacher, we decided to go to a famous mountain in China and walk up this famous mountain, and he wanted to tell me something about Buddhism. And so we arrived in the base of this mountain one Saturday afternoon, and we had to find somewhere to stay for that evening. And he was dressed as a woman, as he usually was on our tours by that time. I'd become comfortable with it, and you know, he was comfortable with it. And so we were walking down the street. We were approached by a woman with carrying booklets and asking if we wanted to stay somewhere. And the teacher was kind of, get back, let me deal with this, because he was afraid I was going to appear too keen and then the price would rise and we would be paying too much money. So he negotiated, and the woman said, look, I've got a house halfway up this beautiful mountain in the forest. Sounded fantastic. And so we agreed to go there. And then the next problem was, well, if it's up a mountain, it's about 5 miles away, something like that. How do we get there? She says, don't worry. My husband has transport. So bearing in mind there are two of us, and we both have, well, he had a wheelie suitcase. I had a rucksack. And a few minutes later, she called her husband on the phone, and a few minutes later, up he comes on a motorbike, and he kind of almost crashed the motorbike on the side of the pavement where we were stood. He kind of got off quite theatrically, like a cowboy dismounting a horse. He'd been drinking. He had a cigarette hanging from the corner of his mouth, and he looked at the teacher and he went for quite a few minutes, and then I said, well, yeah, how are we all going to get on the motorbike? And anyway, his wife then piped up and said, look, I've got my own moped there. So this drunken husband took the teacher on the back of the motorbike, And I could see now as they set off, he was there kind of trying to fight his luggage and head swiveling around as they were kind of ploughing up the hill. And I got on the sat on the back of this very small lady, and the kind of motorbike kind of went like that because I had my rucksack on the back. And we then went off a little bit slower behind them. So we kind of came swooping up the hill, this kind of teacher with his kind of hair flowing and his bag and me behind. And so it was a bit of a sight, yeah.
Do you think, you obviously had a different journey because you were travelling with a native. How do you think that differed to if you'd been travelling with your wife or even on your own?
Yeah, quite a lot, because Chinese people are unfailingly polite. I've mostly found that wherever you go, people will invite you into their homes, cook you a meal, help you out. And so you're left with a very, very good impression, particularly foreigners and particularly Westerners get treated very, very well. But they're not quite as polite with Chinese people. So, and often Chinese people can be quite direct as well. You know, they might say something like, "You're fat," or something quite
but
direct.
They don't say that to you.
Not to me. Well, they would say to me, "You're skinny, you're not eating enough." So they can be quite direct. And travelling with a Chinese person and being able to speak Chinese, you can access that more direct language and the more direct way of approaching things. So, it you know, you found Chinese people as they really are, and obviously everybody's very, very different, but as they really are, rather than the kind of the polite facade which often they put on for Western travellers.
Mm. And did the teacher react differently to incidents that happened to how you did? You talk about Chinese people being actually very accepting of a situation that sometimes might have got you a bit niggled.
He was a show-off. No, he was a bit like the colleague sat next to me. He loved to dress up, and he loved to show it. I remember one instance, we'd eaten a meal in this one town we'd been to the night before, and it was right next to the hotel we were staying in. And the following day, he got dressed up in a long dress. He had a black wig on. He'd put his makeup on, and he wanted to go to the local park. We had a couple of hours left in this town, and he wanted to go to the park and have his photograph taken on a swing. So he would be swinging and I had to take his photograph. But before we got there, he was kind of walking through the street, weaving his way through the chaotic traffic, which it inevitably is in China. And outside this restaurant, there was the owner who was stood leaning, kind of, it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, no meals to serve. And the kind of the teacher went round and he said, "I look beautiful, don't I?" And the restaurant owner was kind of struggling to find the words, and we just breezed on. But, yeah, so he loved to interact with people.
One of the other things that in terms of telling the story of his life and of China as a whole, is about propaganda. And he actually became part of that machine, didn't he, at one stage?
Yeah, I mean, propaganda is a massive thing and a much underreported thing in China. The Chinese Communist Party governs primarily because it people are fed one message from being that high to dying, and so they tend to believe what their government says. I saw an interesting article just the other day that most people in China believe their government than in America, and you know, because
they believe what, sorry?
They believe their government in China, trust their government, trust what officials have to say more than they do, far more than in America. And that's in a country where they can't ask questions. So it's very successful, the propaganda. But yes, my teacher did pay a part. He worked for a big food company, which had its own in-house magazine. So he would sort of like write propaganda stories to make out the company was doing well. And, you know, occasionally he would call up a newspaper journalist he knew to go around to a restaurant that the company owned and write a favourable review and give him a bit of a bribe as well. So, yeah, he was very much a part of that process, and it's a part of Chinese governing that is integral, really.
And he almost met the president.
He did. The president at the time was Jiang Zemin. This was in the 1990s, so he was working on this newspaper, and he worked for the food company I'm talking about, as writing for their in-house newspaper. The president of China at the time was due to visit one of this company's shops, and the security detail around the president has said, "Look, you've got to be there at 6 o'clock in the morning, 2 hours before the president's due to arrive, or you won't get in." My teacher was kind of quite lazy, thought he could talk his way into and out of most things, so he turned up late and didn't get in. So, you know, the biggest work job of his life, he didn't get in. He did manage to get the story afterwards, but it says something about his character. He's kind of quite lackadaisical.
Yeah, he likes to wing it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is what we're doing.
Good, good. So the title of the book, My Tutu Went AWOL, tell us what happened in that incident.
There were two very dangerous ones. The tank one turned very dangerous because they started shelling when he dumped me on the tank. We landed at Kandahar, and the Taliban were shelling the airport every Friday when the plane arrived. And your luggage doesn't come on a nice carousel. They just throw it off the plane on the floor. And I have an obsession that I need to know, because I'm a performer, where my costume is, where my tights are, if they're not on the anti-blast wall, and where my makeup is. And I couldn't find them. And there was a rocket attack that was quite near me, except I would move it nearer with each retelling, obviously. And I didn't get under hard cover, which when Stax found out about that, I got so dressed. I've still got a bump in my clavicle from him jabbing me when he found out about that. And a Marine said to me, listen, you know, don't wait there for another one. The alarm's sounding. Get under hard cover. And I apparently just went, I can't. My tutu's gone AWOL.
And do you remember saying it?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I was running about going, I can't. I remember then saying to him, I can't. I'm going to be useless out here if I can't have my tights, because you'll be able to see I'm not a real ballerina showing my hairy legs. And he said, you'll be useless in general if, one, you're dead, or two, you have no legs. Get under hard cover. So that was quite serious. So they're very shouty, Marines.
Are they?
Yeah. Really shouty. It's like, you're here. 2 feet from me, Stax. There is no need for shout. He did that when he met me on Victory, because we were late. Because, as I said to him, they knelt to shoot us. And he said, where? I said, in the Overspill car park. And he said, why? Is your singing going to be that bad? And it's literally, stop shouting at me from here. This, that, they do that.
Mm. Yeah, that's kind of part of the culture, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, there's no need for it. Sorry.
There's also quite a lot of jargon.
Oh yeah.
Involved in the military side. Did you pick up on that?
They don't let our tour manager was ex-SAS, and they would, because he was out. They wouldn't let him use it because when they made us tea,
meaning out of the military.
Out of the military, yeah. They don't want you to use it because the slang for milk and sugar is a cow and a couple of Julies. I think that's Julie Andrews' spoonful of sugar. I think. And so literally, sir, meaning a civilian, sir, would you like milk and sugar? And he said, yeah, a cow and a couple of Julies. They asked him again, would you like milk and sugar? Yeah, a cow. They wouldn't do it. It was about half an hour of cow and a couple of Julies. No, sir. So I picked up some essence and hoofing mean you're great. Honking and quaffing mean you're rubbish. So
and what about hurrying up and waiting?
There's a lot of hurrying up and waiting.
That's
literally, hurry up, go and sit there. And we were there for 7.5 hours, having been told to hurry up while they did something.
Did that drive you mad?
No, you sit playing... we played Happy Families, but it was like you were playing poker, literally there, with no smiling and no just... And then suddenly, have you got Mrs. Bun, the baker's wife, to the nearest big para? So there's a lot of that. It's nutty. It's completely nutty.
So you obviously became good friends with Stax.
Yes.
And then when you went on your second tour, as it were, out to Afghanistan,
yes.
He was there.
Yes.
Tell us what happened.
Well, it gets very serious because I was going to meet him in Camp Bastion, and he'd warned me, don't upset the garrison sergeant major because he's the biggest, roughest Marine. And you know, because another question people often ask is, did I have homophobia from the squaddies? And I didn't. I only had homophobia from one of the other comedians who said to this garrison sergeant major, who looked like the Cirque of Strongman of old, does he get on your nerves with his camp behaviour? And the garrison sergeant major looked at him and said, what? Do you think I'm impressed with you and your correctly ripped jeans and the right car and whichever girlfriend you've got at the moment? He said, Tutu boy brings a spiritual dimension to his life. And if Steve was here, who's the roughest Marine of all of us, They'd have a lovely afternoon. Steve had come off the killing fields. He'd come twirling off stage. Cup of tea, discuss each other's library books and an earpiece each and watching Oklahoma on mini DVD. So no, he's not getting on my nerves with his camp. But you're getting on my nerves with your ultra-masculine nonsense. So that was the only homophobia I had. Mm-hmm. No, but the sad, the awful thing is that we'd heard there'd been an incident and that a Marine had been killed and one had been shot, and I couldn't find stacks, and so I suspected the worst, and my life was short. I had to go on stage. I had to just get on with the gig. I was looking for him among the Marines, and I couldn't see him. And then at the end of it, a nurse came across the gravel, and she was brilliant. She said immediately, "Your mate is alive, but he's been shot, and he wants to see you in hospital." So that his best mate was killed next to him. So he was the stress. He had his albumin. I remember the whites of his eyes were all grey, and he was just banging his beret against his thigh. It was he had shock. He was in terrible shock over that.
Was he quite pleased that you'd written him almost as the main character in your book?
You know what? After gigs, I will go upstairs and there'll be a text from him that will say, "Did they love me through you?" That I get that all the time. He turns up to gigs. He loves turning up to gigs. He loves to read me, because you have audience survey forms that are given out at a small venue. "Look at this person, Aitja. Look at that. This person says you were the right size for the venue. This person says you must be the love child of Anne Widdecombe. Look at this." So he loves all that. The only thing is, though, I got quite nastily heckled in Manchester. He was there. He stood up. I had to get to him in the audience before he got to this bloke to sort him out. So he gets a bit,
territorial.
Sorry?
Territorial.
He's very territorial of me, yes, which I like.
And what about the teacher? Was he pleased that you wanted to write about him? And did he know that right from the beginning when you first went off travelling?
We had a little bit of to-ing and fro-ing at the beginning because, of course, when I decided to write the book about his life, I didn't know he was a cross-dresser. And so, on the first evening that he showed me he was a cross-dresser, I said, well, you know, this is going to change the nature of the book a little bit. We're writing a story about me and you going around China and how people react to us, and if I can't mention you're wearing women's clothes, then it's not really going to be honest enough. And at first he said, look, I'll think about it, whether you can mention it. And then after a couple of weeks he said, look, I don't want you to mention it because, you know, it's still a sensitive subject in China for certain people. There are certain people who don't approve of what he does, of dressing in as a woman. His wife knows about it, but some of his family aren't particularly happy about it. So he didn't want it to be mentioned if I use his name. So then I left it for a couple of days and we had a bit of an argument. I said, look, I'm going to abandon the whole project because it's just not worth doing, because it just wouldn't be honest enough unless I can mention your clothes. And he agreed, as long as I didn't name him or identify him. So it gives you an indication that a lot of people in China are accepting of people like him, but some people aren't. And he dresses in front of people according to how they expect him to dress. So if he's visiting family and friends or some family who don't approve, then he will dress as a man. But if he's comfortable with who he is, then he dresses as a woman. And I kind of realised as we were travelling across China that the further he was from Beijing, where both he and I lived, and our established life there, the more comfortable he was dressed as a woman. And the closer we got back to Beijing, the more careful and circumspect he became about what he was wearing.
And he doesn't speak English, does he? But
no.
Have you translated some of it for him into Chinese?
I haven't. I've spoken to him on the phone. I've sent him emails in Chinese to kind of tell him what I'm doing, but it isn't in Chinese yet. Hopefully it will be translated into Chinese. And I'm looking forward to kind of, I've sent him a copy and I'm looking forward to going back to China and kind of talking to him about it. I'm not entirely sure he understands, that I'm at events like this talking about him, but so it'll be interesting.
Okay. If you've got a question, do stick your hand up. We've got a microphone here, either about China or Iraq or cross-dressing or anything you like, really. Question just here.
Question for both the guys, really. Number one, Michael, did you get out to like the northwest of Rumki area? And what was the reaction there? And question for Yeston. Try and get your name correct. Ewan?
Yeston.
Yeston.
Yeah. Washing your costume and tutu and things. Fabric conditioner, did you have it in the battlefield as such, or how did it work?
Let's go with the fabric conditioner first.
Yes, do you know that I used to have it on, because it's quite short, sheer, as you saw, and would do it with a wet wipe. I would just keep it going with a wet wipe, but it wasn't clean by the end of 10 days by any means. But I could have, apparently, Stack said something about the book, because I wrote down a country called Adobe Ran. And he had to say, no, that's not a neighbouring country. Adobe Run is Raw Marines Doing Laundry, which was I was offering to do for you. So I could have had it done, but I thought it was a country, Adobe Run. Sorry.
You had to dye your tights when you were out there,
didn't you? I used to dye them in. I had to ask him, could I have loose tea? Because I have to dye... White ballet tights are really cheap, pink ballet tights are really expensive, so I used to dye them in tea, in a bucket of tea by the naffy when I was there.
And did you go to that region?
I feel at a disadvantage, actually, because his answers are always far more illuminating and colourful and interesting than mine. I didn't go to Urumqi with the teacher, but I have been to Urumqi a couple of times whilst I was with the BBC. If you want to know a little bit about it, you know, it's a place where a lot of Uyghurs live, Muslim minority. It's kind of very secure. It's almost a police state there now, very different to the rest of China, a little bit like Tibet, in that the control over Tibet and Xinjiang are almost complete.
Ooh. Other questions, anybody? Yes, there's a question just here.
Did you know, was it Mandarin that you speak? Yeah. Did you know that before you went? So, and how long did it take you to learn the language?
Good question. I still wouldn't claim I'd learnt it fully. I still learn, I still take lessons now, but I did do a little bit of Mandarin whilst I was at university, which is why I got interested in China. But when I left university, I spent 10 years being a journalist and really didn't go back to it. It was only after a decade that I kind of went back to China, and I actually went back with my wife and baby son at the time. He's not a baby anymore, and we kind of studied Chinese for a couple of years before getting the job with the BBC.
There's a question just over here.
What happened when you hit that squaddy? Did it sort of degenerate into a general brawl, or did it quieten down?
Thankfully, he was unpopular, and he had been annoying that garrison sergeant major, Reg. And so I was very much in Reg's good books for actually smacking him. He was really nasty, his heckle. I'm not going to repeat it because, you know, this is a nice afternoon. And so I was perfectly within my rights, but he decided he better not do anything because Reg was watching him and Stax was back there as well. So
Always useful to have a couple of minders.
It's always very good to have... If you have the minder of the Garrison Sergeant Major, there are two of the hardest Marines of all time, Reg and Steve, his mate. And so you don't mess with either of them.
Okay, good advice.
Very good advice.
Don't mess with them.
No.
I've got a final question to both of you. What was it that you think you learnt about yourselves in doing these journeys?
Well, you can ask that question first.
That I'm resilient, and that I actually liked the idea of having very little. I loved that. You can't have anything. You have no Wi-Fi. You're in a tent. You've got nice food. You have to go and get your own water. I loved all that. 30 seconds shower and no more. I liked. I found that I liked bedsit life. You don't need much. Food and raiment, that's what I found, and resilience. And just getting on with it in all, no matter, you don't sleep. I was injured, I had desert fever.
Oh.
And you just get on with it because it's not about you. You are there for them. I learned that my ego is not the most important thing. It is. But I learned that it's sort of, according to some people, it isn't. But it's very good that your ego is like, and it's good for you.
Okay, Michael?
I suppose as a journalist, you're always trying to find the truth out of any event, whatever you look into, whatever you write about, whatever you report on. And being in China, I'd been in China by the time I started researching the book for 5 years, or actually 7 years, but I realised that I didn't know everything, and I don't know everything, and you always have to keep asking questions and going to different places and trying to find out things to try and understand the whole of something. I know it sounds quite dull, but, you know, as a journalist, it's quite important to try and find out those things. And the teacher allowed me to see the world through a slightly different lens, and that's always important.
It is. It's very important that one remembers one doesn't know everything. Sudhguru says that. The mind is supposed to be confused. Your mind is not... So, I think it's, you're supposed to know you don't know.
I'm the wisest person ever.
You are. You've been very interested in going around here, joining the WR. Yeah.
So, Michael and Yestin are going to be over in the Stamford Stand signing. These two books, as I said, they're really, really different. Yestin, it's an absolute riot. And Michael, yours is a very interesting way of looking at a country and taking us through that. This is the last event of the Stamford Travel Writers Festival, and we are going to ask Yestin to sing us out.
When I was dumped on the tank, Stax and I, because we've now gigged... I'll stand up for this. So you must imagine, I'm looking down at him, and he's looking up at me, and he said, "That is the naughty tank, and you're not getting off there till you sing me the song I like from Victory." And we can't remember what I sang on Victory... So I'm going to do something quite touching for you, but that's hopefully funny. I've been put in seven people's wills over years to sing at their funerals, four down, three to go. I did one about 3 weeks ago, a mate of mine in Aldborough. And Stax put himself on that list, but he doesn't want anything maudlin, like Ave Maria. He wants me to sing the five fake Welsh songs that I've been writing since I was asked to leave the Llangollen Eisteddfod. I can't tell you why I was asked to leave the Eisteddfod. Let's just say that lift door opened a lot sooner than we thought it was going to. And so I've been writing these fake Welsh songs. All you need to know is that I have had this, because I opened in my double bill for Madame Galena. I am my own warm-up act, which is really skits. And Madame Galena always gets more applause than I do. So I was talking to my Aunt Sophia about it, and she said, "Oh, don't worry about it, love." She's Welsh, by the way. "Your Uncle Donald, he's just been sectioned again in Massey Cummer. Your cousin's getting married. He was sending out on the invitations, using for postage, the defunct Green Shield stamps from the cupboard under the stairs." So you just need to know that to understand why I've written these songs. And obviously there's no piano, because I'd be on the runway as the plane came in. "Saucepans from IKEA, set of three. Saucepans from IKEA, set of three. But the bradle, it doesn't fit the screws." That's the first one. "Her up the road, she've bought new curtains. Awful colour, shades of catsick. Patterned sofa walls and carpet. Turns your eyes kaleidoscopic." That's the second one. This is the one that's based on family truth. "Look round, my van wee, empty chapel. Uncle Donald's messed up with the invite. Used his defunct Green Shield stamps for postage. Still convinced he's Tutankhamun's aunt." That's the third one. And the fourth one, this is also sadly a truth story in my family. "My nan's moved to Blackwood, four doors down from Letty. She says it's a bungalow, but with upstairs." And the big finish. "Mary bought some ham at Asda. 6 months its sell-by date past her. Jamboree up Swansea Way wrote off 10 Portaloos."
Michael Bristow, Yestin Edwards, go meet them.
Thank you.